Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
It has been called the Great Destroyer and the Evil. The Pentagon refers to it as the pervasive menace. It destroys cars, fells bridges, sinks ships, sparks house fires, and nearly brought down the Statue of Liberty. We are talking about rust. And rust costs America more than $400 billion per year, more than all other natural disasters combined. Journalist Jonathan Waldman traveled from Key West, Florida to Prudhoe Bay, Alaska to learn how rust affects everything from the design of our currency to the composition of our tap water, and it will determine the legacy we leave on this planet. Jonathan Waldman's new book is Rust, The Longest War, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you with us. What got you thinking about rust and thinking about it enough that you wanted to write a book about it?
It's a good question. So I made a pretty bad decision in 2007. I bought an old 40-foot sailboat, and I spent the next couple years fixing everything imaginable on that boat. And I realized that rust was way more than I learned in high school. It's not just a simple chemical reaction, but this huge force. It's been called the Great Destroyer and the Evil, and I guess I sort of experienced that over the 2 years of refitting that boat and draining my bank account in the process. So I started looking at how other people must be battling the same thing, and boy, are there a lot of people battling this thing, but we just don't see them.
So before we talk about those who battle it and this force that is out there to try to battle rust, let's talk about what rust is. So what do we know about rust and what causes it?
So the basic, I hate to say mechanics, the chemistry of rust is pretty simple. Oxygen just happens to be the most abundant element on Earth, and it's pretty much attacking, I like to say it's attacking mankind's most important material everywhere all the time, but what it's trying to do is just steal electrons, and it's really, really good at that. And there's only there's probably 10 different ways rust manifests itself, and I tried to steer clear of the nitty-gritty science, but the fact is there's also only so many things we can do about it, so I sort of left it at that. But oxygen and metal, they do not mix.
So when you have a boat and it starts to rust, then how is that different from having soda in a can for however long of that not rusting?
Good question. I guess I used the word rust colloquially. A couple engineers have pointed out, hey, rust is the oxidation of iron, and you're talking about the corrosion of other metals, but rust is just first of all, it's a four-letter word.
Right.
It's also just simpler to say. With boats, you know, you're in the ocean. You've got salt water and salty air, and everything imaginable is rusting. And I remember when we took our boat for a sea trial, which is kind of like a marine version of a test drive, The very first time we put her in the water and took her out to sea, the engine overheated on the way out of the marina because the heat exchanger in the diesel engine was all caked up with rust, and it was so embarrassing and humiliating to have to get towed out of the marina in a boat that we were about to buy. But elsewhere, when you're not in a boat, like in a can, what a lot of chemists are busy doing is trying to figure out how to prevent rust before it happens. And kind of a good example of how dangerously corrosive some of the beverages that we put in cans are is that every once in a while, some of them explode and in a warehouse, and say Mountain Dew gets out of one can in this huge stack of pallets, and that Mountain Dew gets on the outside of a bunch of cans below it, and it corrodes those cans from the outside in, and then those all explode. And I heard guys in the canning industry tell me that sometimes entire warehouses of soda, millions of dollars of soda, have been written off because of what they call one leaker on top of the case.
Mm.
So in the world of cans, it's all about preventing corrosion. And they do this by very carefully studying the chemistry of the stuff that goes into the can and by very carefully designing the plastic lining of the can that protects it from what they call the product.
Yes, the product.
The product. Makes it taste real good, right?
Yeah,
sounds like it tastes
absolutely
good. And I talked to the corrosion engineer who runs what they call the packaging services lab at the biggest can making company in the world, and he told me that one in seven new energy drinks are too corrosive to put in cans, which makes you feel really good about drinking
right.
some of those things. So he has to call them up and say, hey, I'm sorry, your stuff, you know, you got to put in less caffeine or less dye or cut down on the salt, but like we just can't put it in a can.
So rust has been called the great destroyer and the evil and the pervasive menace. You talk about your boat, but you also write in the book about the Navy. And this is a huge deal for the Navy, an annual cost of $5 billion just to fight rust.
More than that, actually, $15 billion in the Defense Department.
Wow.
Yeah.
Overall, for everything.
Yeah, and so the funny part about that was obviously it's a huge toll, but as a former boat owner, it did make me feel a little better. I thought, well, I might have drained my bank account, but like, gosh, at least I'm not in the Navy or the Pentagon.
Did you get rid of the boat because of the rust?
I got rid of the boat for a lot of reasons. I came up with the book idea, and there were three of us guys. We were about to turn 30, and like I said, the bad decision was we were all getting in it in this little boat and sail across an ocean, and it was just kind of a lot of, maybe I'll say a lot of type A personalities in a very small space. And I think I'm also a landlubber at heart. So my buddies actually sailed the boat to Australia, but I did not.
You didn't take part in that. That would have been a different book. When it comes to what the Navy is trying to do is trying to take action against rust. And as you point out, they've been successful in some ways and unsuccessful in others.
Yeah, it's funny. The head of the corrosion office in the Pentagon is a really quirky man, and he's kind of got this 8-point program of attacking rust. He's on this rust crusade, and he's only been doing this for, I guess, 13 years now. And at first, a lot of the higher-ups in the DOD were very, they said, come on, I got missiles to worry about. I got important, you know, homeland security-type things to focus on. You're talking about rust? I mean, this is not our problem. But slowly people have come around, and he's done what he calls, he's woven corrosion into the fabric of the Defense Department. And by this he means that now every program coming into the DOD, from the president's new helicopter to the space fence, has to be vetted to be sure it has some way of addressing or preventing or fighting rust. But before that happened, he did a lot of things that we've all done. He looked into making sure that planes have covers or that they have dehumidifiers or sensors in ballast tanks on huge ships, because that's one of the leading rust headaches in the Navy. So he sort of had to do a lot of what we all have to do, maybe in our homes or you know, our farms or wherever we are.
You read a chapter in the book I found it fascinating because it's something I've thought about, and that is about rust in the automotive industry. We've gotten much better, haven't we, of dealing with that. I mean, I remember, like, my first cars were just, you know, they were rust buckets, as they were called. And
yeah.
And you see less and less of that now. We've gotten much better at fighting rust.
Yeah. I hate to say this, Joe, I'm not quite as old as you are, but I do remember my dad had an old VW, and it was painted orange, and it was also rusty orange.
Right.
And I remember as a kid climbing into it, and you know, you open the door and you look down, and I remember seeing rust still. And I've talked to a guy who's a consultant for the auto industry, and he told me that cars pretty much turn the corner right around to the year 2000.
Yeah.
And it all has to do with how well paint sticks. Apparently, a lot of corrosion sciences is studying how well paint sticks. And I want to jump back for a second because the Navy does this too. They study how well paint sticks. And they've got this corrosion lab on Key West, where they keep little squares of metal on the beach, and they look at what exposure to the really corrosive air does to them. And the funniest thing about it is they've got some really good paints, but some of them turn pink. And I can tell you that the Navy does not go for paints that turn pink.
They're not happy with that.
Nope.
Makes sense. So then how applicable is that technology in other places, in the sense of, okay, so we've done this in cars and in the automotive sector, so this can help us in other realms?
Yeah. I pointed out about a week ago that pipeline coatings also have gotten a lot better. They're actually made from the same resin that they use to make can coatings and car coatings. I mean, there's only so many different ways you can make paint, and the really good paints all come from the same stuff. So I bring that up partly because the Alaska pipeline was coated with some paint that was discovered before the pipeline was completed. It was discovered to crack in the cold and not stick very well. And I guess it's sort of the same with cars. We've come a long way. The new things we have are far superior. But the thing is, there's also only so many ways you can fight rust, and paint is one of them. And there's a few other methods, but really, there's not that much we can do. So paint is, I mean, we're a good way there with that.
You write a lot about the Statue of Liberty and the efforts to de-rust Lady Liberty, and quite an effort.
Yeah, it was dramatic. I'm quite partial to that story because it has this amazing beginning. Two climbers kind of doing a protest action. They got some 8-inch suction cups, and they snuck over to the statue one morning back in 1980, and they started climbing up the statue hoping that they would bivy on her shoulder for a week and draw national attention and protest of the arrest and imprisonment of a Black Panther. But they couldn't make it because the statue had all these holes in it, and the suction cups, they started to slip, and they got caught, and they got arrested, and they got, not convicted, but they were accused of damaging the statue by putting all these holes in it. And what it did is it got the superintendent of the national park to look with binoculars at the statue, and that's pretty much the first time he saw these holes and went, oh my gosh, what's wrong? And they accused the climbers of using pitons, of driving metal spikes into the skin of the statue, and they said, we didn't use pitons, we used suction cups, we don't even have pitons with us. And it turned out all the holes were from the copper rivets separating from the iron frame that holds the statue. And I just love that story because it really took this weird action for a guy to in charge of maintenance, and he's a very good maintenance officer, but no one had looked at it before. We put a huge copper thing in New York Harbor and pretty much let it sit there for 100 years, and it was so bad by 1980 that engineers soon determined it was at serious, I think they called it structurally deficient, and the torch, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say parts of the torch almost fell down.
Yeah. So a great renovation effort, and where are we now? I mean, how long is it expected to last before it needs to be worked on again?
I like that question. Our country's been here 240 years.
Yeah.
The corrosion consultant to the Park Service estimated that the copper skin would last something like another 1,000 years.
All right.
Yeah, so we're good.
we can plan our vacations. We're all right on that?
I think so, yeah.
I was surprised. You mentioned it a couple of times in the book, and I guess I just didn't even think about this, which is why I love the book, because it makes you think about things you've never thought about before, of just how many corrosion offices there are in this world. Texas Instruments has a corrosion office. The Navy has a corrosion office. There's a lot of corrosion offices in the world.
Yeah, and the amazing thing, a lot of them, this is sort of the hard part about writing the book, a lot of them didn't actually want to let me in. And this is not, I don't say that accusingly, but we're all kind of embarrassed by rust. And so I think what happened is a lot of them said, you know, we'd love to have you, but we've got all these projects where we're solving rust problems for companies who basically don't want to admit that we have rust problems. So yeah, we have them, and I saw a few of them, but I there were times where I wish I had like an all-entry pass and I could have gone places and said, show me your rust problems, but it didn't quite happen like that.
Why doesn't money, why don't coins rust?
You know, I don't know the actual science to that. There's a guy named Bob Baboyan down in Rhode Island who was a consultant to the U.S. Treasury, who helped ensure that the alloy that we use for coins was not susceptible to the oils in our fingers or whatever. I don't know if the lint in our pockets has some acid in it too, but he made sure that our money doesn't literally corrode away, which is kind of the, if I had that, I'd put that at the very top of my resume.
Right, absolutely. And he was the same guy that figured out the Statue of Liberty, right?
He was, and he discovered a couple other really cool things. He suggested that the torch in the statue was kind of this big bungled nightmare, and it turns out that the guy who sculpted Mount Rushmore was the same guy who originally cut all the holes in the torch so lights could shine out and you could see it from Manhattan and New Jersey, and that design let all this water in, and then birds got in, and there was this big ooze of sort of primordial bird poop and water corroding the whole thing away. And Bob Baboyan was the guy who said, you know, we got to do this right. We got to redo the whole thing, coat it in a very special varnish, almost like an old violin, and then on top of that, stick gold leaf. And he had actually suggested that they redo the torch a lot like they did the Capitol Dome in Rhode Island, but they didn't. And so he goes back to the statue every couple of years and he checks it out to make sure that it's in good condition. And he told me recently, he said, you know, it's almost time to redo it, and I think this time we got to redo it like the dome down in Rhode Island.
Mm. It's a fascinating story that you tell in the book. It is Rust, The Longest War. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Jonathan Waldman, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. And again, it's really a delightful book. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. That was fun.
Really appreciate it. Again, the title of the book, Rust, The Longest War. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.